You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
The role of legal columnist is a challenging one. Every day you put your work out for scrutiny by a profession trained to spot the tiniest factual mistake, a split infinitive, or just an unconvincing argument. And the people you interview, judges, solicitors, barristers, are sensitive souls who are jumpy about any perceived slight. With me today is someone who spent nearly 40 years as a legal journalist and editor, overseeing huge changes in the legal profession and indeed in the law itself. Francis Gibb started as legal correspondent for The Times in 1982 and has just retired. Francis, no doubt you're feeling a great sense of relief.
It's funny. It's mixed. I mean, I shall miss it greatly. And I haven't quite appreciated that I have retired yet. I think I feel as though I'm on an extended holiday.
When you started at The Times, it was the first time the job of legal correspondent was given to somebody without a law qualification. Is that correct?
That's correct. It wasn't really a developed area in that not many newspapers even had people whose sole job it was to cover the law. And I took over from Marcel Berlins, who's quite well known, still is, as a crime writer and critic. And he decided he wanted to leave and focus on his writing. So I, at that time, was a general reporter on The Times. And I decided I would try and go for the job. I had had a specialism before on the Daily Telegraph, not in law, covering the sale room world. And I thought this would be a more satisfying thing to do than being a general reporter when you're very much at the beck and call of the news desk, up at all hours, out to knock on doors, you know, covering disasters and one thing and another. And so I applied for it. But yes, you're absolutely right. They were a little bit concerned that I wasn't a lawyer and therefore how would I be able to write about the law?
So what were your responsibilities at the Times?
Well, as a correspondent, and this applies across the board really, whether you're covering law or any other subject, you have to cover the news in your patch. And in law, that meant breaking news stories, whether it be a speech from a chairman of the bar, judges ranting about something, or solicitors, you know, putting out a discussion paper. It could be any number of things, or most at that time, things coming from the government by way of proposals to change the structure of the profession. So basically, it's keeping on top of the news and ideally getting scoops ahead of your rivals. That's what it is.
And you had some encounters with members of the judiciary that perhaps weren't ideal, were they?
No, actually, it was a while on, but this one encounter actually did reflect, I think, a prevailing view that had been picked up in some of the trade press at that time, that how on earth could the Times appoint somebody who wasn't a lawyer? And I had to ring up Mr. Justice Harmon, who at that time was in the news because he had taken about 20 months to deliver a judgment. So, of course, this was a good story. Everybody was wanting to write it and they wanted a comment from him. And when I did ring him, he was pretty withering, as he could be. He was famously rude. And he said, "Are you a member of the bar?" And I said, "No, I'm sorry, I'm not." And he said, "Oh, are you then perhaps a solicitor?" And I said, "No, I'm not that either." And there was a long pause and he said very disdainfully, "But I thought you were the legal correspondent of the Times." So that was a fairly typical encounter in those days.
And I also remember a story involving the Lord Chancellor and his war paper. Is that correct?
Yes, half and half. That was another amusing episode in hindsight. The Lord Chancellor at that time was Derry Irvine, who was very well known for his numerous subcommittees and his role, as he kept boasting about, in cabinet and chairing this and that and bringing in devolution and the Human Rights Act and one thing and another. But the press were more interested in the fact that he had spent £60,000 I think it was, a role on redecorating his Pugin apartments. Now, I didn't get that story, but shortly after that, I went to see him and I did an interview and he gave me a speech he delivered. It hadn't been reported, so it was a sort of mini exclusive. And in this speech, he had likened his position to that of Henry VIII's famous Chancellor, Cardinal Wolsey. And I wrote this story. It duly appeared on the front page of the Times, but it had massive traction because it came against the background of the wallpaper and all the boastfulness and the arrogance and the pompousness. And all the tabloid papers went absolutely to town on it and did great big spreads of Derry Irvine dressed up as Cardinal Wolsey and all his palaces. So I'm afraid he never forgave me for that. And subsequently, when I sat opposite him at a legal dinner, he was rather rude.
And I think, didn't Lord Denning get entangled in something that you wrote?
Yes, that was slightly different in that Denning was really lovely and he wasn't rude in the way that either Mr Justice Harmon or Derry Irvine were. But what happened with Lord Denning was that he had a book that... one of his many books, in which he talked about the jurors in the Bristol riots case. This was, from memory, about 1981. And in that, he had talked about how the black defendants in the trial of the Bristol rioters had sought to pack the jury, which you could at that time try to influence the composition through using the right of peremptory challenge, which has since been abolished, as you know. And he said, really made a point about how immigrants were not really fit to be on jurors. I'm probably putting it a bit more strongly, but it was along those lines, and said that they would never convict a black defendant. So the point was is that this episode that he wrote about had been picked up by the New Statesman. So I didn't have it completely as an exclusive, but in those days, before the internet, if something appeared in a magazine like that, unless it was picked up by a national paper, it wouldn't get wider publicity. And so it was when I wrote it in the Times that it really got publicity. And there was an absolute fury. He phoned me when I was at home that morning in bed with my husband about 8 o'clock or even earlier, and was very, very aggrieved and said, "Why did you write this?" And I said, "Well, because it's a story, you know." And he duly had, the book had to be withdrawn, or that section of it pulped. And not long after, a matter of weeks later, he stepped down as Master of the Rolls, which he had a position he'd held, I think, at that point for about 20 years.
With that in mind, in retrospect, do you think that there's been a huge sea change in the attitude of the judiciary to the media and vice versa?
Yes. I mean, at that time, it was a very, very closed world in that PR for the legal profession didn't really exist in the way it exists now. And when I was appointed, I had to hunt out the chairman of the bar and come and find him in his chambers and, you know, arrange to have a coffee. And that was all rather kind of archaic. And the judiciary, likewise, Lord Lane, who was Lord Chief Justice at that time, we never gave interviews on principle. So there was no contact between the top judiciary and the media. But it did change after Lord Lane left, not just because of him, but that was one part of the slow change that was going on. And what we got then were the beginnings of openness in that the judiciary gave press conferences and they started Lord Taylor of Gosforth, whose time was sadly cut short because he died, but he actually went on BBC Question Time, which was quite a remarkable thing at that time. So judiciary started to give press conferences. The professional bodies of the Bar and the Law Society and similar all had their own press offices. The judiciary had their own press offices. This all kind of developed over time, but it made a huge difference. And it developed as an area where there was a kind of two-way process. You know, we were after the stories and they were wanting to give us stories of a kind. I mean, you know, their own things, obviously. But yes, that was a big change.
But I wonder whether it's slightly two-edged sword, because since they became media savvy and they were in charge of the stories, did that make it more difficult for investigative journalists and editors in your position to get to the nub of things?
Yes, it was a two-edged sword, because whereas you could get the more routine stuff, so if somebody was making, a judge or a senior legal politician was making a speech, that would all be much easier. You could get hold of it. There were channels to go through. But against that, and this is again over time, Whitehall in particular developed quite a controlling influence over how stories emerged. And I can remember that in the 80s, I would quite often have lunches or drinks with senior officials, and particularly the permanent secretaries in what was then called the Lord Chancellor's Department. And that was extremely useful, obviously, because they would chat and give you gossip and say, we're thinking of bringing forward proposals on X or Y. But of course, that all stopped. I mean, it really stopped with a vengeance, I think, finally, under Tony Blair's government, where all the control then came from Number 10 and Downing Street, and then was continued by David Cameron. So you don't have that sort of access. I mean, I can't remember the last time I had a lunch with a permanent secretary.
Whilst we're on the subject of the changes that you've seen in recent years, what about the legal profession itself? What do you think is strikingly different about it now?
Well, first of all, it's massively bigger, so that you get these huge corporate law firms, which are like industries in their own right. You get big, big chambers. So it's not the little cozy world of small firms and small chambers anymore. It's a much more professional and organised setup. It also looks very different in that half the entrants, both to the bar and the solicitor's profession, are now women. And that obviously is fantastic. And when I started covering this world, it was very, very predominantly men, not entirely. Having said that, it's still quite difficult, I think, and there's quite a big fall off of women who make it to the top. And although we do now, for the first time in legal history, have a woman at the top of the Supreme Court in Brenda Hale. So that obviously is fantastic and shows people that that can be done. It's a possible position to aim for. I think it's just that it's a difficult job, as many are, to combine looking after children or parental responsibilities with the very, very busy and unpredictable demands of clients, be it going to court for a criminal case or a big commercial deal. It's just tough, very tough. And so you'd have to have a very understanding partner or be wealthy enough to afford a good network of support. It's just difficult. And that still remains, I think, a very big challenge. And that's not to say people should be deterred. I think everybody should give it a go, but it's not easy.
Just turning to substantive law now, again, in your career, you've seen some changes that were brought about by stories that legal press covered, for example, miscarriages of justice that you uncovered.
Yes, I mean, there were, at the time I was taking over, and in Lord Lane's tenure, there were a series of high-profile miscarriages of justice, and we're still feeling the ripples of them today with the Birmingham Six, and then there was the Guildford Four. And I can remember, because it was a very dramatic day when the Guildford Four were released, and I was outside the Old Bailey, and Jerry Conlon came out and made the most dramatic, it was electrifying, really, speech after having been in prison, I think, for 14 years. But these high-profile miscarriages gave rise to a couple of royal commissions, and those in turn gave rise to the Crown Prosecution Service as we know it today. That was really in 1986, I think. But people are quite surprised. They think, goodness, hasn't it been around forever? You know, but no, it hasn't. And at the same time, changes to the police rules on interrogation and obtaining evidence. The Police and Criminal Evidence Act was a landmark act, and it just put a stop, mostly, to sort of banging suspects up and taking them round the block in the back of the police van to extract a confession. So at least there now were set procedures they had to follow. That really was a massive change.
More recently, sticking with the interface between the judiciary and the media, there was the Daily Mail Enemies of the People headline in response to the Gina Miller ruling. Can you remind us what that was all about?
Yes, I mean, that was a really fascinating case in recent years, probably one of the most interesting I've ever covered. Initially, that was in the High Court, and then, of course, it went to the Supreme Court, where it had worldwide attention because the proceedings there are live streamed. That was about a challenge to the procedure for triggering Brexit, still on Brexit, and whether once the procedure is triggered, Article 50, the doing of that has to be subject to parliamentary approval, whether it can just be executive action. And so Gina Miller was one of a group of people, but she led the case and was seeking to have the courts rule, as they did, that this had required parliamentary approval. So first that went to the High Court, where it was heard by the then Lord Chief Justice, Lord Thomas, and two other very senior judges. And that's where we then got the absolute outpouring of vitriol, not just in the media, but although very famously, the enemies of the people, as you mentioned, headline, and also in quarters of Parliament as well, with some backbench politicians. And it really was a disgraceful episode, because whatever one thought of that decision, the judiciary in this country that are supposed to be above the fray of politics, and indeed are above the fray of politics, I believe. And there should be a greater understanding, which there didn't appear to be then anyway, of their role and the importance of an independent judiciary and the rule of law, and how if you don't like it, that's just too bad. That is the ruling, and you can maybe challenge it some other way or seek to change the law through Parliament or under general election. Of course, that decision was then confirmed by the Supreme Court. But by that time, I think ministers were mindful of that furore and did not step forward to attack the judges in the way that had been done, or at least they were quicker to defend judges who, if they did come under attack.
In the months running up to your retirement, you've covered some very interesting stories. Are there any that you particularly want to talk about?
Just by way of a contrast, because that last one, the Gina Miller case, was a very interesting constitutional case. But by way of a more human interest case, and one that I was in court day after day because it went on through so many hearings and in so many different courts, was the Charlie Gard case. And that was the tragic case of the little boy who had a terminal disease and whose parents wanted to take him out of the country to try some experimental treatment in the States. And the judges, repeatedly over and again and in many different courts and rulings, declined to grant that permission. And I think the parents found that incredibly hard. And it was a fascinating case, because emotions were running very, very high. And obviously, one's heart went out to them. And when the mother, well, indeed both the parents, but when the final ruling came, and I think they realised that was the end of the road, there weren't going to be any more appeals, they made a very heartfelt statement in court, which was, it reduced most of us listening to tears, even though one didn't necessarily sympathise with their legal arguments. It was, on a personal level, it was really upsetting and sad. It was also interesting because the barristers in that case and the solicitors had quite a rough time of it because of the role of social media. That is a big change in recent years, as is obviously the internet generally. And they got a lot of flack and a lot of grief, as did Great Ormond Street, who were looking after the child. And I think that was a hard job for the people standing up doing that job in the face of all that criticism, day in, day out, death threats, everything, and the most horrible abuse.
Well, thank you very much for this whistle-stop tour, a very interesting career spanning four decades.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.